Hello and welcome to The Rundown, a podcast from Politics Home. I'm your host, Alan Tolhurst. And after last week's somewhat downbeat look at how the voters are feeling about the country as we head towards the general election, we thought perhaps we could offer a more positive look at politics and why we should fight against apathy. So who better to have on the episode than Joe Phillips and David Seymour, who've just published a new book, Why Vote? How to Make Your Voice Heard in a World of Broken Politics, alongside my colleague, Paul Home reporter, Caitlin Doherty, who I don't think anyone could describe as apathetic about politics. So Joe and David, you're both experienced journalists who've worked around politics for many years. What is the argument for why people should get out and vote when Rishi Sunak finally calls an election this year?
Because apathy is dangerous. It's absolutely dangerous. It is the biggest threat to democracy. And I know that sounds ridiculous and overdramatic, but it's true. What we're trying to say in the book is that people over 65, the turnout amongst that age group in 2019 was about 77%. For people under 30, it's about 55%. So do we really want a country and a future that is decided by people? And this is not about young and old, but actually, if you want to have a stake in the future, there's no point in sitting at home moaning about it. And it really doesn't take any effort. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be political geeks like us. You just have to get your bum off your seat or do a postal vote.
Yeah.
But take part. It's your right. And I would argue it's your duty.
David. And what you can be absolutely sure of is that you may think, possibly do think, and it may actually be true that if you vote, may not achieve very much. But what you can be absolutely certain of is that if you don't vote, you're not voting and you're just letting the government be formed by other people.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one weapon that most people have is to actually go out and cast that vote, put that X on the ballot form, and maybe it will have.
I mean, there are more people who didn't vote for the current government,
yes,
than did. Yeah. It's utterly bonkers, you know. And as we say in the book, you know, to use a football analogy, it's like, would you let your team? We won't talk about teams here, but
sure,
you know, would you let your team be subject to, well, the other team, they've decided actually they're going to have 20 players and we're going to make it last a little bit longer, but only when you score a goal. Oh, actually, no, we're going to blow the whistle because I think we're going to play a different game. But that's what we've got. We've got politics and a government. And don't forget, you know, we vote for a parliament. We don't vote for a government. Mm. And we've seen democracy traduced over the last 14 years and particularly over the last 10 years with Partygate, with Brexit, with shenanigans in the Tory party where we've had six different leaders and no continuity in ministerial posts. Mm. So the really big issues that matter to everybody, you know, whether it's getting an appointment for a doctor or a hospital, whether it's getting your kids into school, whether it's potholes in your road, whether it's getting on the housing ladder or out of temporary accommodation, whether it's being able to work and how much you get, all of those things, climate change, food security, war in the Middle East, war in Ukraine, all of those things people are interested in.
Yeah.
But when you say to them, are you interested in politics? They go, oh, no, they're all the same. Well, those things are politics.
Yeah.
And it's politicians who can change the weather.
That was something I found really interesting about the book, actually, having a quick flick through it. Towards the end, you've got chapters which make reference to Marcus Rashford's school meal campaign, Partygate, the fire at Grenfell Tower, those sort of big news moments that we've had over the last 6 or 7 years that people maybe don't engage with necessarily instantly as a political issue, but then as we sort of delve more and more into them, it becomes perfectly clear that they are, in fact, that. Are those the sort of moments when people do become engaged in politics?
Well, I think people can see that the influence of people like Marcus Rashford or Greta Thunberg, various individuals and groups, whether it's trade unions or whether it's Me Too, whether it's J.K. Rowling on transgender issues, whether it's the transgender community on their issues, all of those things, whether it's Black Lives Matter, everybody's voice is equal and should have equal weight. But those campaigns bring things to the fore because it's ever so easy to go, well, they should do something about this. Well, who's they? In the case of Grenfell, actually, it was the local council, the developers, the dodgy cladding and all the rest of it. And we know that residents campaigned and protested, you know, loud and long, but weren't listened to. The school meals campaign, you know, it took one charismatic footballer to say, what are you doing? Why aren't these kids having free school meals?
Yeah.
during COVID. You know, I would love nobody more than Marcus Rashford to get that book and hold it up high and say to his followers, this is what you need to do.
David, you wrote a version of this book, I think, back in 2010. Why did you choose now to update it and lengthen it significantly? What were the reasons behind that?
Well, I think things have changed so much since 2010. I mean, at that election, we'd had Labour in power for 13 years. Things were sort of settled, really, but for the Labour Party. But they were coming to the stage where it looked like we were going to have change. What we didn't realise was that the change was going to be, we're going to have our first coalition government for, I can't remember how long now, but it was a very long time.
Since the wartime, yeah.
Outside wartime, for really much longer. Things were changing a lot, but then the procession of things that have happened in these 14 years that since 2010 is really quite extraordinary. I mean, for example, probably number one is the biggest change that they say that any country has ever inflicted on itself is the Brexit vote. I've said, Joe and I were both involved in the Remain campaign for a long time, long before the referendum was called. But to me, the really extraordinary thing wasn't that 52% of the people who voted to get out, but that 17.4 million British people voted to shoot this country in the head, not in the foot, but in the head. You know, you have to ask why. You have to ask what sort of people knew about it, about why we were in the EU. They seemed to know nothing about the history, nothing about the economics of it. And we're learning a very, very hard lesson by it. And that's the sort of thing that, I mean, I think that Joe and I agree that in some ways, the number one thing is we're saying, people, you've got to vote, but there's got to be a reason you vote. We're not saying vote for any particular party. That's not what this is all about. It's about knowing enough, having enough education to do it. And schools ought to be doing it. Parents ought to be doing it. There ought to be discussions in. And when I started as a reporter a very long time ago, we used to have, when there was a general election, you used to have public meetings and people used to go along to the public meetings.
Yeah. But just to go back to why we've done an update, it wasn't just Brexit. We've then had COVID, you know, the biggest change to so many of our lives. And beyond our control, other than the measures that the government didn't or didn't bring in whilst they were partying or not partying. But, you know, let's not go down that route. We've also had, you know, we've got war on mainland Europe. We've got a war fought the old-fashioned way in the trenches with tanks and artillery. Meanwhile, we've got social media and fake information. We've had Donald Trump. We've got war raging in the Middle East. All of these things will have an impact on our lives, and they can be little things or they can be big things. And sometimes we have to look beyond. But the other thing is really that this isn't just about a general election. It's also about local elections. Yeah. It's about your local council, you know, your town council. It's all of those things that have an effect on our everyday lives. And some of those seem big and some of them seem insurmountable. But you're never going to change anything if you just sit at home moaning or just go on social media.
Yeah, and actually casting your vote in the May elections just coming up could be the difference between whether that local service that you want to keep going does keep going or not, essentially. Sometimes feels remote, but actually there are links that you can do that directly have an effect on you if you go and cast your ballot.
Well, there's a perfect example, actually, in the book, which is, you probably remember, the under cover of darkness, the felling of the trees in Plymouth.
Yeah.
Despite a huge campaign from local people saying, "We, you know, there's nothing wrong with these trees. We don't want to lose them, da, 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 da." Anyway, the council went ahead. They lopped off the trees. And it was a few weeks before the local elections. The entire council was booted out. The leader had to resign. That council has had to apologise and pay back. And that is an example of, you're not going to take us for fools again. Mm. You know, you can hold people to account.
Caitlin, on that kind of stuff, we're talking about the last sort of decade and that feeling, I guess, that people have of a bit of despair that I've definitely picked up from voters, that voting one way or the other doesn't really matter and things are going from bad to worse regardless of what happens. You know, the parties are quite worried, I think, both Tories especially, but also Labour as well, whether they can actually get people to turn out and vote when this election happens.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a big question at the general election that's coming up. Whichever way it goes. And, you know, this is a dynamic that plays in several directions. You know, some people you talk to will say voter turnout is always lower when people think it's a dead cert that a certain party or a certain candidate is going to win. And that works, you know, does that work play out on a national scale? You know, we've regularly seen Labour polling around 20 points ahead for some time now. Will that alter the turnout of the Labour backing electorate, but then also with the Conservatives as well? You know, we hear a lot about traditional Conservative voters who have maybe been put off by the last few years of politics, and, you know, are they're considering whether or not they want to vote Conservative this time. Will they stay at home? They won't necessarily vote Labour or Liberal Democrat, but will they turn out to vote full stop? And you can see that playing out as well at any election on a seat by seat basis. There are so many what we call safe seats in this country traditionally, and that might be something that's switching up and a little bit different this time around. We talk a lot about the blue wall, the, you know, so-called safe Conservative seats in and around the South East and London. We now know a lot about the red wall, the idea of the northern seats and the seats in the Midlands that had traditionally been Labour and have flipped Conservative since 2015, but also the vast majority of them in 2019. But there is a bit of a realignment happening at the moment, and that idea of a safe seat isn't necessarily as set in stone as it has been. There are plenty of seats that are being spoken about that maybe have been traditionally Conservative that could now flip Lib Dem or Labour.
Might be able to draw people out and say, look, you could actually make a difference this time.
It's and not in the same way, it's what happened in 2019 in all of these seats which were traditionally red that have flipped blue. I think there is probably a bit of a realignment going on at the moment. Maybe 5, 10, 15 years down the line, what we consider a safe Labour, Conservative or Liberal Democrat seat might be very different. But it feels like at this election, and certainly the last election, and maybe the one before that, was the time where that process was sort of flipping.
Come back to that kind of sort of the, around that aspect of it, but I wanted to talk maybe about the electoral system that we have. And David, we talked about how in with first past the post, there are lots of wasted votes. And I wonder if that actually pushes people towards apathy because they think, well, I'm in a seat where the current incumbent has got a 30,000 majority. Why should I vote at all, essentially? But there is a reason to vote in that point, isn't it? You have to cast your vote to show that signal that you want to go one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could say some people, if you think, let's say, for example, you're a Conservative voter and you think they're going to get a 30,000 majority, what's the point of going out? It's raining. On the other hand, if you want to vote tactically, and tactical voting, which I first started writing about, I don't know, 30 or more years ago, it's now become quite a big thing, particularly when there's a by-election. But you know, you've got to be really keen on voting to get, let's say, the Conservatives out of a particular seat. Oh, I'm a natural Labour voter, but I will vote for the Lib Dems, for example, this time, because I get rid of them. And maybe it's not then a wasted vote, but I don't really want to vote for them. So which is, all of which is pointing more and more that we ought to have a much better system.
I think what's interesting is that, well, several things really. One is that I think people have got much more canny, they're less tribal, and they are doing exactly what David says. If they want to get rid of the Tory or Labour, they're willing to lend their vote, if you like, to the person who is most likely to win. And we now have this extraordinary alliance between the Greens, Reform, the Lib Dems and various other smaller parties actually calling for a review of proportional representation, which would make a huge difference. You're then going to get all the nerds going, oh, but do you want the single transferable vote or do you want this? At which point you just think, please take me away from this, and you give it. But actually, your vote should count and it should be equal. And it isn't at the moment, even though we're arguing that everybody's vote should count. So you have to use it how you think it's going to be used best. And the other thing I would say is that the Rochdale by-election, forget George Galloway, as many people will when he fails to do anything useful in Parliament. But what was really interesting was the person who came second was a local businessman who'd got no political affiliation, but actually spoke to local people about local issues.
Yeah, interesting.
A few experts and sort of commentators have picked up on this idea of local candidates and the influence of local candidacy. A piece that we, Politics Home, have published, I spoke to Lord Robert Hayward, Conservative peer, but also elections expert. I think it's pretty fair to say, and he was speaking about voter apathy, and he thinks one of the ways that the parties are trying to challenge this is by increasing their number of local candidates. All of the issues that we've spoken about that have happened over the last 6 or 7 years, you know, Brexit, the COVID pandemic, Partygate, the conflicts in the Middle East and in Europe, they are issues that are obviously seen very much on a national scale. Level. But, you know, constituencies always have their sort of individual local problems.
And that's always the argument in favour of first past the post, is that it has the strongest constituency link. And there are other methods that will do so, but yeah. I don't want to make Joe do that the nerd voice again about when I talk about different voting systems. But that's why people, but if you can have that local link, can't you, with yeah. your MP, and therefore actually that might people draw people out to want to vote, right?
Well, that is one way Lord Hayward thinks parties are. I mean, they're doing it for a number of reasons, and I'm sure there are what they perceive to be many benefits to having these local candidates, but tackling apathy, he thinks, could be a buy-off from that, you know, feeling like there is that local connection, somebody that knows your area, somebody that knows about the COVID pandemic and Brexit, but also knows where the potholes are, which school is struggling, which GP surgery doesn't necessarily have the places, etc., etc. So an election is 650 mini elections, and like you said, you elect a parliament rather than a government.
Well, actually, that's interesting. So Kat Smith, who was on the podcast last week, was talking about how we need to improve civics lessons so people understand. One of the classic ones is that I think people don't necessarily always realise that how we even elect a prime minister. The prime minister is not simply the person who gets like the most votes in total. It's who gets the most seats. And so actually, do we maybe talk a lot about young people and their lack of voting at the moment and whether we need to improve those sorts of things? But part of it probably, David, is maybe making sure that when people are teenagers and younger, they understand how politics works, or so it's not so arcane. You know, when I first became a reporter in Parliament, you know, you learn about the gentleman usher of the Black Rod and the manor of the North End, Chilton, the Hundred. All this kind of stuff. And it's a bit alienating, I suppose, if you're not used to understanding how politics works. Maybe do we need to break down some of those barriers to get more people involved and want to have to cast their vote?
Yeah, I mean, I was involved for a number of years when I was still working on the Daily Mirror with the UK Youth Parliament,
yeah,
which met every year.
And I think it's funding cut at the moment, I think.
Yeah, every funding cut for everything. And one of the things was that they wanted to meet in the Chamber of the Commons, and the then Speaker refused to let them have, because the gentleman of the Black Rod,
or whoever it was,
said, "Oh, you can't do that."
Someone in tights.
When John Bercow became Speaker, I know a lot said against John Bercow. He said, "Well, of course they must meet there." Yeah. They met in the Chamber. It was brilliant. You could get it on YouTube or whatever afterwards. You could watch these debates. They're fantastic. And I sat in after one of the general elections. There was a meeting held not far from here where there were about 20 young people who I think were either just coming up to vote for the first time or had just got the first time vote. And the only old people there were Michael Brunson, then the political editor of ITV, and me. And we sat outside and didn't open our mouths. And these young people were fantastic discussing the issues. They were so knowledgeable and so articulate and so clearly thought about it. But they are a small minority.
Yeah, yeah.
So the question is, how do you get all young people thinking like that? Because then they would get involved.
Yeah, Joe?
Absolutely. It should be part of our education, you know, in the same way as people quite rightly argue that we need to teach children about finance.
Yes.
You know, finance and civics, whatever you want to call it, those are the things that are going to affect your life. That should happen from an early age. You know, primary school children are very capable of understanding, who do we choose? Who do we want to vote for to do this X, Y, Z? They understand the basic principle that they choose and the person with the most votes wins that particular thing. But I mean, I would personally like to see the age of majority lowered to 16,
yep,
but also to make voting compulsory. And I don't think that is a problem, as long as you've got the option for people to say none of the above.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I know people don't like being forced into things.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly understandable.
Yeah, countries like Australia seem to do it quite
but,
well.
But, you know, people do it. And it would be really simple. At the age of 16, you get your national insurance number. You also get your voting number.
Yeah.
And you just get into the habit of it. Because if we don't make this a habit, whether it's by turning up in person to the polling station or doing it by post, turning up in person, the government's made it even more difficult because of photo ID.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know this sounds far-fetched, but would you ever think that perhaps if Suella Braverman or somebody of her ilk was still wielding power, you could say, well, if you haven't voted in the last 3 years, you lose your right to vote? I mean, You know, we've seen some bonkers things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think voting 16 is a good. I think more support for that. I think as we go forward, I think definitely the compulsory voting. I know there's lots of people who think that maybe you're not tackling the causes of why people aren't voting in that sense, which people think that actually it's better to get people to want to vote rather than forcing them into voting. Is that what you think, David?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot more to it than just getting people to go out to vote. I mean, I remember I used to many years ago. I used to be very active in politics. And I would go around, not every Sunday, but most Sundays, knocking on people's door, saying, you know, we're from the Labour Party then, but the Tories did it as well. And you occasionally see pictures on Twitter now of here's four people who've gone out knocking on the doors for the Tories. But I can't remember the last time anybody knocked on my door and said, how are you interested? Did you even know that there's
an election?
All you do
up.
Is you get the poll card that comes through your letterbox and you know where you go or you don't know where to go. And there used to be, I remember many, many years ago, I had been living in Hertfordshire in a marginal seat and it was really hard work. We were out the whole time because every vote did count. And I then moved to Hackney, where, of course, what was the expression?
You weigh the votes. You
weigh
the
Labour votes. And I said, well, what are we going out and doing? Are we going to have people on the poll? Why? Well, you know, because to me, that's as much of a... If it's a civic duty that you should turn up to vote, it's jolly well a civic duty for the political parties to engage with the voters, you know, and to talk to them about it. And of course you don't like sometimes what they say, and people say I don't want to speak to you. But to me, it's really, really, really important. That's why I think... It's a great idea to have local people wanting to stand, but I think something has happened as well to political parties over the time I've been involved in politics. I have seen both Labour and Conservative parties changed out of all recognition to how they were 30, 40 years ago. I mean, the big thing for Labour was became much more professional from the chaos that they used to be in the 70s, 80s. People say, yeah, that's jolly, jolly good that it's professional. But to a certain extent, it meant lopping off people who weren't going to go and knock on doors. Mm. And the Tories, the Brexit vote was not a huge surprise to me because I'd seen the people who belonged to the Conservative Party through that period of 20 years ago and more... Somebody like Ken Clark, who had been a fantastic chancellor, I think one of the best chancellors, handed over a fantastic legacy in 1997 when Blair won the election. He was being booed by members of his own party. And those people weren't interested in potholes and whatever. They were obsessed with, you know, the ideology
I think the other thing is, you know, we've seen the demise of local papers and cuts to BBC local radio. And, you know, although we are awash with information, it's quite hard to find out what's going on in your local area. You suddenly realise, oh, that field that used to be a playing field has been sold off and they're going to build 500 houses on it. How didn't I know about that?
Yeah.
So you've got to now make much more effort to do those things. And although there are social media groups and Facebook groups and neighbourhood organisations and things, which really came to the fore during COVID in supporting people, we almost need to have a reinvention of that sort of, I don't know, that sort of political drumbeat, if you like.
Yeah.
How do you think that dynamic plays out when it comes to votes happening at the same time? I mean, we're in early April now. All the way through February and March felt like one of the big questions was going to be, is Rishi Sunak going to call the general election on the 2nd of May? And that would have put it on the same day as loads of local council elections in England and mayoral elections. You know, some of the big, Andy Burnham, Andy Street, Ben Houchen, all up for re-election, Sadiq Khan. If people had been voting on May the 2nd for their MPs as well as their local figures, how would that have played out? What do you think would have taken precedence on people's minds?
Well, you'd have got a lot more coverage for a start because you'd have got coverage. I mean, where I live in Kent, we haven't got any local elections. We've only got police and crime commissioner, apart from the unitary authorities. And yours is the same, isn't it? So, you know, it depends where you live. Mm. But if you had everything on the same day, then obviously you would have that sort of mass coverage. I mean, I used to work for Paddy Ashdown, as you know. The Liberal Democrats used to get a lot more coverage during election period because there was, and still is, a rule about, you know, parity.
Equal coverage.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, that makes a huge difference, I think.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it will be very interesting to see what the turnout is like.
Yes.
Particularly in London, where I think, you know, to a certain extent, it's a given. that Sadiq Khan will win, mainly because the other candidates are so absolutely atrocious, particularly the Tory one. But, you know, if Andy Street was to lose in the West Midlands, that would be a bitter blow for Sunak and actually for the people of the West Midlands.
Yeah.
But, you know, the mayors and that devolution of power has had a huge impact on people. I mean, the stuff that Andy Street and Andy Burnham have done separately and together has made a massive difference on everyday things, like free buses.
For sake. But again, I don't think there was ever much of enough of an explanation about what those powers were in separation from the government, and therefore turnout. I looked at the turnout for last year's local elections, and it was less than a third, I think, for the first time. We talked a little bit before about young voters, and it's a bit of a vicious cycle, isn't it? Because if young people don't vote, I think in two elections and recently, the young person vote was below 40% in two general elections. Whereas for older people, I think in the above 65, it's around nearly 80%. You know, so therefore, why would you target policies at young people if they're not going to vote? But then if young people feel they've got no buy-in, that no people are pushing forward policies that are attractive to them, then why bother, essentially?
I think that's the impact of that is something that's emerging more and more in the talk of policy creation for this general election that's coming up. A question that I think could be asked would be whether the issues that people perceive to be the issues of 18 to 24 year olds 10, 15 years ago, are they now the issues of people in their 30s getting into their 40s because maybe they've not been the policy priority from there to now?
But I think one of the things that has to be said is that policy priorities change. They change for people because, you know, you could say, well, certainly if you went back to the last election, we'll keep saying there was no war in Ukraine, there was no COVID, a hospital situation is far, far worse, the economic situation has been far, far worse.
And Brexit was on the ballot paper effectively with, you know, the choice between Johnson and Corbyn.
And it now doesn't seem to be, although there are various people, myself included, who think that it jolly well ought to be on the ballot paper. The politicians need to be nimble to keep moving, to reacting to what the public say without making it look as if they changed their mind and their policies, whatever whim it is. But I also think that I wonder if one of the key issues affecting how people will vote or how people not voting is the question of honesty. And I really think, I know I've been told by some people that this is just an old man looking back through rose-tinted spectacles, but I honestly believe that the way that politicians used to be different, everybody, you know, it always used to be, people say, oh, politicians always lie. Not true that politicians always lie. There's always a certain distortion, as there's bound to be, as we all are in our lives anyway. But now there is blatant lying and people are aware of it. You know, if you've been one of 7 million people waiting for a hospital appointment and you see the Secretary of State for Health on the television or on the radio saying, oh no, we put more money in, everything's all right. What is the point of any of this?
I think that's really important, that point about honesty. And, you know, Boris Johnson led the pack on dishonesty on an industrial scale. He lied to Parliament, he lied to the public, he lied to the Queen, the late Queen.
Actually, Partygate, in the focus groups we did, actually Partygate did come up quite a few times, almost unprompted from people. And I guess maybe in Westminster, for us, we've kind of maybe moved on, two prime ministers on, essentially. But I think for the public,
But people haven't moved on because people know very well and remember what they were told to do and the sacrifices they made. And the sheer stupidity of Boris Johnson lying when there was photographic evidence. And I think it has really, really damaged democracy. I mean, honestly, not only has he effectively destroyed the Conservative Party, for which I don't fly a flag, but has been one of the most successful and influential political parties in the world, and is now a rabble desperately moving further to the right to try and catch Nigel Farage. You know, we need grown-up politicians for very serious times ahead. And just to go back to that point that Caitlin made about the sort of the change, that's another reason why if you start people voting at 16, what matters when you're 16 will have changed by the time you're 20, and it will have changed again by the time you're 26. And we need to get into people's minds that, yes, it's great to go out and protest, and all of that is absolutely fine, but protest is performative. Power will make a difference. And the only way to do that is to use your vote.
There's an interesting point that I think should be raised here, that if you are a young person on a 0 hours contract earning the minimum wage, it absolutely infuriates you to hear politicians say, we've put it up, and we've just put it up in the last 3 days, it's gone up by a pound an hour, to say they're now all earning, what is it, 18,000 a year or something. It's just not true, because what employers do is they cut the hours, they bring you in when you want to do it. So if you're a young person, top of your priorities isn't going out to vote whether it's for the council elections or whether it's for when the general election comes. It's saying, I haven't got enough money to live on, I can't pay a rent. You know, the rents have gone up through the ceiling. Sunak saying, oh yes, we've cut national insurance. It's no blooming use when you've just had your council tax billed through the letterbox, putting it up by 5.5%.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that's the kind of, if there was that pool of young voters who, if it was compulsory, they would, you'd know those voters would be there, they would perhaps focus some of the minds essentially on putting forward policies that specifically push forward. And that's why when we see things like the Conservatives' kind of obsession with keeping the pensions triple lock and other kind of things which are clearly aimed towards the much older voters, because they know that time in, time out, those people are going to vote because they were brought up with the idea of making sure you definitely voted. Whereas at some point along the line, we talk about trust being breached, whether there was a point at which those people coming through stopped voting in those numbers.
I think it's worth saying that the triple lock isn't just a Conservative concern. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen Keir Starmer asked about it, I think, more than once. You know, this is a question now that's put to any and every major party and any and every major party leader. You know, will the triple lock be maintained? Will it be maintained on the conditions that it currently has? And I think that is probably the policy that people go to when they are trying to think of an example of, you know, a policy that suits the electorate which are the most likely to vote. It's probably the most obvious recent example that we've got. And I don't know what the answer to this is, but I would be fascinated to know at what age somebody becomes more likely to vote than not. If you said that turnout among the lowest cohort maybe sits, you know, around 50%, if not under, at what point do you become more likely to vote than not?
When something happens to you, usually. But by that point, and if you've grown up surrounded by people, whether it's your family or your peers, who don't vote or who go, oh, they're all the same, they, you know, they tell lies, they make empty promises, you're just going to feel hopeless. And I think the point about this is that it's not a magic wand. It's not going to change anything overnight, but it is your stake to actually say, I do believe in a future. I want to make a future better. And I know that it's going to take time, but I'm prepared to invest 5 minutes to vote in order to have some hope that it isn't just about the triple lock. And, you know, there are cohorts of people who, for a variety of reasons, not least of all because they live in insecure housing, it's quite difficult to register to vote. And that will include a large number of younger Black voters. I mean, the registration levels, despite the fabulous efforts of Operation Black Vote, are really, really low. Mm. But, you know, if you don't know where you're going to be living for months into the future, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, if you're a student, you've got the biggest opportunity amongst anybody to use your vote, because you can work out whether your vote's going to make more difference
in a university
where
town
you're studying.
Well, then you're trying to stop that.
Well, I know, but they haven't at the moment. But, you know, I mean, that's why Canterbury, which is the constituency I am, you know,
went
turned Labour
yeah.
because of the student vote. Mm.
There's also, I think, an interesting issue is that, of course, the triple lock stuff is aimed at getting older voters in and voting for whichever party is saying it. And as you say, it's pretty well all of them. But what is never said is, but do any of these pensioners think, why have we got just about the lowest state pension in the developed world? Nobody says that. Well, they wouldn't, would they? You know, but where's the thought of among the older people in what they're doing? Mm. I mean, is it possible to make the state pension much lower than it is at the moment? It's a disgrace. And we've seen, of course, with the WASPI women, what's happened there. There's, I can't remember the exact number, was it 1 million women affected by that? So you have to, I think, Joe's talked quite rightly about the effect of the dearth of local newspapers, but the national newspapers, in particular, much more than broadcasting, you have to look at their role and where are the issues coming from? Are the issues actually coming from the centre of government, the centre of opposition, or are they being driven by some sort of strange views of people in what used to be called Fleet Street?
The proprietors, yeah. Well, Caitlin, before we wrap up then, I was going to say actually that what we're seeing now in terms of in the Conservative Party, that battle between the sort of the NIMBYs and the YIMBYs, the sort of the ones who don't want to see stuff being built, the kind of traditionalists, but the kind of growing cohort of YIMBYs who think that actually there is a number of young people's votes out there that could be won if you had much more pro-housing policies. And actually there are even older Conservative voters now who have children or grandchildren who can't get on the housing market, and actually that is going to be influencing them. So we're going to see that kind of both ends, really.
Well, perhaps the greatest manifestation of that in the last 18 months or so has been the growth of groups like Next Gen Tories.
Yeah.
They launched, I believe, at the end of 2022, and they've now got quite a few Conservative MPs signed up. And, you know, their whole ideal is that there is a whole batch of young Conservative votes out there.
You've not voted before, so you could get them, again, as Joe says, get them for the first time to vote and then, you know, keep them, essentially.
But they need to be taking in mind these priorities of voters who are under 40, which, you know, come around the issues that we've mentioned, like housing, like childcare, like the economy. And it's about, you know, what they want is for the Conservative Party to be accessing what they believe to be this really big pool of potential Conservative votes that maybe aren't being tapped into at the moment.
I think one of the things which is really, it's never talked about now because there's such agreement between all the political parties that what matters is home ownership. This is Mrs. Thatcher did this. I mean, I rented when I first started work. I then went to work in Hemel Hempstead, which was a new town, and there was New Town Commission. We all lived in what would now be called council housing. Thatcher sold the whole lot off, didn't invest any of the money. Young people cannot afford to buy houses, not at the prices that they are now. And yet no one is really talking about doing something with social housing. Yes, there's got to be a lot more housing built, but we must go back to having social housing so that people have somewhere to live. I mean, whatever bad the situation is now, I bet you in 10 years' time it's going to be worse. 20 years, there's going to be many more people living on streets, families, children, living on the streets, living in hotels. I don't know what, because people cannot afford this idea. Affordable housing for millions and millions of people means affordable rental housing. They can move on from there and maybe begin to get onto the property ladder. But at the moment, we're heading to absolute disaster for the next generation.
Joe, final word then to you. That's a classic example of why you should vote, because there is obviously lots of reasons why you would want to on that. So just last word to you, like, what would be the overarching, the kind of final message that you try and deliver from the book then?
Try and look behind what you see on social media and where the information comes. Because all the time, there's an argument about whether the National Trust is secretly making vegan scones, which I have to say I thought was an April Fool. But actually, they've been using that recipe for the last 12 years, and it's not secret. While those things fill up the pages for a variety of reasons that we go into the book, we have a duty as citizens to find out what's going on, to hold people to account, to ask questions. And that doesn't matter whether it's, you know, the shop that you get your fast fashion from, the stuff you put on your face for makeup, the food you eat and where it comes from and how it's produced. We care about those things as consumers. And I would say that we need to be a bit more consumery about our politicians at every level and ask the sort of questions we would do when we're booking a holiday. It's absolutely bonkers. These people have control over so much of our lives, and it's up to us to hold them to account.
That's all we've got time for this week, but you can read all the latest on the big stories from Westminster at politicshome.com and keep right up to date by subscribing to our 7-day week newsletters by clicking on the link on our homepage. Thanks to our brilliant guests, Joe Phillips and David Seymour, along with my colleague, Caitlin Doherty. Thanks all for listening. Please subscribe wherever you podcast and leave us a nice review. And if you want to get in touch, then reach out to us on Twitter at politicshome, or you can email us via news@politicshome.com. But for now, I've been Alan Tolhurst, and this has been The Rundown.